You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Previously on Electric Boogaloo.
The thing about parrots is like, yeah, they can talk, but they're just kind of repeating sounds. It's that little dance that they do, that little head move. Good Lord, that is intoxicating.
Welcome to Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. We'll be covering my favorite chapter from this early portion of the book. This is Jon and Tyrion outside of the party at Winterfell. I'll be talking with one of my favorite people to talk about Game of Thrones with. That is Stephanie Barbey Hammer. You'll remember her from the prologue. I'll also include a short excerpt of my interview with the linguist who invented High Valyrian and Dothraki for the HBO series. That's David Peterson. Just a short snippet of my interview with him. In between those interviews, we'll check in with Steve. And if you'll indulge just a little bit of self-promotion, Gods of Thrones Volumes 1 and 2 are inexpensive and available on Amazon. Aaron and I tried to keep these both informative and entertaining. I think you can get both volumes for under $20 or thereabouts. So keep that in mind as you're holiday shopping. Without further ado, here is Stephanie Barbey Hammer. Back again with me is Stephanie Barbey Hammer, poet, author, literary magician. How's that for an intro?
Wow, yeah. I love the idea of being a magician. I accept that compliment with great pleasure. Thank you so much. And it's great to be back talking with you.
I'm really happy to have you back. So I'm talking with one of my favorite people. We're talking about one of my favorite chapters.
Yeah, it's a great chapter. So let's get into it for sure.
So we are covering Jon Snow, and this is his first POV.
Yeah, it is.
The first time we see Jon's interior anyway.
Yeah, for sure. And the placement, I'm so happy that you invited me to take a look at and talk with you about this chapter, because it got me to kind of look not just at the chapter itself, but its placement. Mm-hmm. And its placement is so interesting, because it's not the first kid's point of view, because that's Bran, mm-hmm. but he's the second kid, and he's sandwiched in between an Eddard chapter and a Catelyn chapter, I think. Is that right?
I think that's exactly right. And I'm glad you mentioned it. I hadn't thought about the placement, but clearly, just reading a little bit further to the Catelyn chapter, there is something of a wedge between Eddard and Catelyn that Jon Snow represents, right?
Right, right. And we get Bran, who, of course, is the favorite child. You know, he's the baby. Mm-hmm. And we were just talking about how you were a middle child. So you know that the baby always receives this very favored treatment in a large family. So we start with the favorite baby. And then we get, as our second child, the baby who isn't wanted, the interloper baby, who's the problem.
He's the problem, and probably because of that, well, two things about Jon. One is we learn about Jon that he's, in the parlance of the book, he's a bastard, right?
Yeah.
We already knew that about him, but what we also learn about him here is that bastards in this culture grow up more quickly. So he's known he's been a problem his whole life, and that has created a certain complication to his existence and made him maybe older than his years would suggest.
Yeah, he's only 14, which really surprised me as I was rereading the chapter.
Yes. And I think Martin does a great job at capturing a 14-year-old boy's voice. What do you think?
I agree. And not just a 14-year-old's voice, but getting back to what you were just saying, a 14-year-old who's trying really hard to be an 18-year-old.
Exactly.
Yeah. And kind of and succeeding at moments and then really failing because he gets so drunk.
Yeah, that's right. The second thing I was thinking about with John is that he's perceptive. And there's a couple moments in this chapter where he's not so self-involved that he can't see what's going on around him.
Yeah, great point. I tend to think of 14-year-olds, I certainly think of myself, as being quite narcissistic at 14. But he's not. You're absolutely right. He's amazingly outward directed.
Well, okay, let me do my quick synopsis here. We begin with John, who is trying to convince himself that sometimes being not a Stark is a good thing. And he's sitting at a lower table. So he doesn't have the pressures of sitting at high table with his brothers and sisters. And one of the perks is that he gets to drink as much as he wants. We get a little interaction with he and Ghost, the name of his wolf. And then we see him impress, in a couple ways, his uncle Benjen. And that's when we learn that John is probably a little bit too drunk and reveals a little bit too much of himself. It probably reveals that he's less mature than he would like to believe. We learn that he wants to take the black, go to the wall with Benjen, take the oath, and he has a really big problem with his social status. He never wants to father a child out of wedlock. This deeply offends him. And he runs outside weeping, where he meets Tyrion. And this is really one of our first introductions to Tyrion, and probably the most robust introduction to Tyrion. And those two have a very memorable exchange. That is the chapter in a nutshell. And of course, we're going to want to unpack all of the morsels of this delicious meal.
Yeah, it's really a terribly important chapter, but it's also such a rewarding one, I think. I love your adjective, robust. It is just kind of a wonderful meal.
I love this chapter. In fact, this first season of this podcast, we're covering the prologue to chapter 9. So we're finishing with the Tyrion POV chapter. And of all of these chapters, I think this is probably my favorite of the 9.
Yeah. What do you love about it?
Well, two key characters, Jon and Tyrion, have a very meaningful exchange. And they both carry around with them some kind of wound. And for one of them, the wound, maybe healed over a little bit, becomes sort of like a scar that he, like I'm thinking of Tyrion, a scar that you're proud of. Like Tyrion has become hardened to this idea of being disabled.
Yeah. And
he's become he's become the curator of all the best jokes of being a dwarf. He can always play a higher suited card whenever anyone jokes about him being a dwarf. For John, the wound he's carrying is probably relates to his relationship with Catelyn and how he's always been reminded over and over again that he doesn't really belong. And for him, it's still raw. It's like a raw nerve. It's almost like these two wounded creatures meet each other and for a brief moment are able to help each other in a way. What do you think about that?
Yeah, they're able to connect. Well, I love your point about woundedness because I hadn't thought about the two characters in that particular way. As you probably remember, I'm actually interested in trauma and how trauma gets represented in literature, and it's something that I've written about.
Yeah.
And they are both, not to put too fine a point on, but they're both trauma survivors in certain ways. Tyrion carries the birth trauma of knowing that he killed his mother when he was born. And so he has that he's carrying, as well as being really, at least so far in the book, the most radically other of everyone in this story so far.
Yeah, not only does he carry the guilt about being the cause of his mother's death, he also says that his father's never forgotten it. Or maybe he even says, my father's never let me forget it, or something
right,
like that.
Right. So he's been continually kind of re-traumatized by his own family. And then I loved your point, too, about disability. This is, to put it mildly, a pretty ableist society.
Yeah.
And it becomes a very, Tyrion's character really makes a very uncomfortable mirror for us, where we have to kind of go think to ourselves, oh, wait a minute, this world, which seems so different than ours, it's, you know, it's got the dire wolves, it's medieval. Oh, it's not so different. because we live in an incredibly ableist society too.
That's right. George Martin has said that this relationship between the Starks and the Lannisters is in many ways, well, at least inspired by the War of the Roses.
Yeah.
So Tyrion in this story is not based on Richard III so much as he's based on the rumors of Richard III.
That's right.
He's a twisted creature.
Right.
And not just twisted, but twisted in such a way that in this particular society, this bespeaks one's twisted character, but it also bespeaks how well the gods love the person. And Martin has said this about Tyrion, that Tyrion is hated by the gods, and that's how people would have seen him. Hated by the gods, why else would the gods have done this to his body?
Right.
So even though our culture also has a lot of these peccadilloes, there's almost this almost theological force behind the world that Tyrion has to live in. In fact, maybe it's the show. I forget where I learned this. But at one point, Tyrion says, hey, if I wasn't born wealthy, they probably would have taken me out to the woods. So Tyrion's disability, I mean, in many ways, he's very able-bodied.
Indeed. But
it's the social stigmas to his particular disabilities that we're interested in. It's, you know, because you can easily wear an eye patch in this culture. No one's going to think twice. But if you look like Tyrion looks, then people are going to make all kinds of assumptions about who you are and what the things that you're capable of. I think Richard III was, the rumor was that he killed two highborn children. That's how evil he was. He's a child murderer. And of course, Tyrion gets accused of this sort of thing too, right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so that in a way, Tyrion, and I think that the book really emphasizes this more than the TV show does, Tyrion really is monstrous, or
yes,
appears monstrous to other people in the world of the book.
Yes.
Peter Dinklage is so handsome
that
he's such a star that he is bringing something very different to that character. But in the book, Tyrion is monstrous looking. He's not just small.
Yes. And one of the key features of these ancient Greek and Roman physiognomic writers, these writers who would talk about how someone's phenotypes would represent their character.
Right.
They are most interested. I mean, they have lots of thoughts about lots of different phenotypes, but they are most interested in the eyes being the window to the soul.
Oh, yeah. And there's Tyrion with the non-matching eyes.
Exactly. And that would be this comes into our culture too. Like when people are described with beady eyes or whatever, that is a carryover from ancient physiognomy.
Oh, but how interesting.
Tyrion, I mean, if ever you could just size someone's character up just by looking at them, those mismatched eyes are going to justify a lot of abuse that people hurl upon him, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm thinking, as you're talking about classical or Shakespearean understandings of the topics we're talking about, and this is making me think about bastards in Shakespeare.
Oh, tell me more.
And in particular, I'm thinking about a very charming, dangerous bastard, and that is Edmund from King Lear, who is incredibly charismatic and wrecks a huge amount of havoc before he's finally undone by the actions of the play. But at one point, Edmund says something like, and paraphrasing incorrectly, something like, "Up with bastards," or "Hooray for bastards," because actual brother, you know, half brother, "I'm going to take your title and your land. I'm going to take it from you." And he does.
Right.
And thinking how, again, we tend to think of bastards, you know, thanks to Shakespeare and thanks to Western culture, we tend to think of bastards as dangerous, dangerous to the order. And certainly that's how Catelyn views John. And so how great is it to get that drunk 14-year-old who is not dangerous. He's many things. He's quite complex, but he's not a plotter. He's this earnest, passionate young kid who wants to be taken seriously and who's desperately trying to find a place in the world.
Yeah, and we already know about him that he's willingly slotting himself into the social roles that would be afforded to a bastard.
Indeed.
He's not really trying to like reach above his social station.
Right. Unlike Shakespeare's Edmund, totally unlike him. Yeah, I almost think happily, and I was looking at our chapter last night and looking at that opening where John goes into great detail, or rather Martin goes into great detail as to where John is seated. And he's seated way at the back of this grand feast, sitting at a bench, you know, not at the high table with the dogs. And, you know, it's kind of it's the area where anything goes. And that's what's great about it, is anything goes. You can have your dire wolf with you. You can drink like crazy. Mm-hmm. You can spear the chicken and, you know, shove it under the table and give it to the dogs. There's a freedom to being not in the elite.
Well, I think that John is really trying to convince himself that there are moments where not having every eye in the room on you is a benefit.
Yeah.
And yet he's drinking enough that we learned that him trying to convince himself that actually being a bastard is not so bad, that's something of a superficial story he's telling himself.
Yeah. And yet, again, this is the genius of Martin's writing. And yet at the same time, there is something very wonderful about not being, I love your expression, under the eye of everybody, because it enables you to look and see everybody else. And that's how the entire first section of that chapter is working. We are finally seeing the Lannisters very clearly for the first time through John's eyes, because John, as the sort of unprivileged, you know, family member, is also the privileged looker because he's got the best seat.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I wanted to talk about John's eyes as a theme.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So I want to read one little passage here. Okay. So he's watching the procession, or the all of the pomp and circumstance of the entry,
like,
of the Lord.
It's like graduation, isn't it? It's so funny.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, have you ever sat at high table?
Don't think I have.
So I got my PhD in Durham, and the college that I was a part of was called St. John's. And I never really spent much time outside of the library at St. John's, but I was always told that because I was a PhD student, I would have at some particular fancy meal, I could sit at high table, which was like a raised table.
Wow. Like Dumbledore. And sorry,
exactly.
We're talking about a different set of books.
No, exactly. So yeah, I was going to be able to get the Dumbledore treatment. And I never did it because I thought, man, that is some classist bullshit. I'm not participating in that. All right. So I spent all of my PhD years avoiding that situation. And then I got a job interview at Oxford, which, by the way, I didn't get that.
Oh, interesting.
It was bizarre. And at that moment, I was reading this, like thinking back to that, you know, a sort of medieval stone room and the oddness of being, you know, sitting up at high table. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think you were pointing in a bunch of very interesting directions. I mean, yes, absolutely. The classism of it is kind of astounding. And yeah. I think Martin is very aware of that, which interests me. But I think the other piece is we're back to your wonderful point a couple minutes ago about being under the eye of people. Because when you're sitting at the high table, it's not like you're relaxing, enjoying yourself. You're performing a certain social function. And arguably, you need to be, you can't get too drunk, although God knows the king doesn't worry about that. Yeah. But Ned sure does. Everybody else is concerned about, because you're performing a certain social function, yes, and everyone's looking at you.
That's exactly it. So here's the passage I was going to read. His lord father had come first, escorting the queen. She was as beautiful as the men said, a jeweled tiara gleamed against her long golden hair, its emeralds a perfect match for the green of her eyes. His father helped her up the steps to the dais and led her to her seat, but the queen never so much as looked at him. Even at 14, John could see through her smile.
Yeah.
So we have a couple things there. First, we learn that the queen's green eyes are stunning. They're like jewels. So we get the eyes theme there. But we find out what she's doing with those eyes.
Yeah. Right?
She's not connecting with Ned Stark. She's never looking at her escort. And with John's eyes, he can kind of see right through her.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I love that.
Yeah, me too. And that's the first description that we get in this processional of people coming in. Mm-hmm. And that sentence, even at 14, John could see through her smile. That tells us everything about her, first mm-hmm. of all. She's trouble. She doesn't even deign to look at Ned. He's not even there as far as she's concerned. Mm-hmm. And that smile, it's so false. It's so artificial that even a drunk 14-year-old kid can see through it and says, oh, she's a phony. And of course, teenagers are great at spotting that anyway. But it also tells us something about John, who, again, it may be drunk, but he's noticing, yep, she's gorgeous. Yep, check out that crown. Yep, it matches her eyes. She's not even looking at Dad. Mm-hmm. Look at that smile. That's a razor-sharp brain working yes. there.
And I think that passage has a twin a couple pages later. Here's also from John's perspective. He's talking to his uncle and he says, the queen is angry too, John told his uncle in a low, quiet voice. Father took the king down to the crypts this afternoon. The queen didn't want him to go. Benjen gave John a careful, measuring look. You don't miss much, do you, John? We could use a man like you on the wall.
Yeah.
Okay, so Stephanie, guest choice. Would you like to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or would you like to climb the ladder of chaos?
I think I want to talk a little bit more about, have us talk a little bit more about Tyrion.
Yes.
Because this is our kind of our introduction to him, and he's so important.
He's important. He's beloved. He's got complexity that you would wish, you know, you would wish every novel would have a character that's as complex as Tyrion Lannister.
Yes,
right?
I agree. And back to all the things he's able to do, they did not use this part in the TV show, mm-hmm. I don't think, but Tyrion cannonballing off the ledge.
Yes, he does do that.
And doing this kind of acrobatic, you know, maneuver.
Yes.
Which, of course, is talking again in such an uncomfortable but great way with the roles and jobs that little people have been able to get in our society, namely by being jesters and most especially working in the circus.
That's right. And Martin has voiced some regret about this passage.
Oh, has he?
He has. In fact, he said that if he could take one thing back, it's that passage, because at that point in the story, he was thinking to make Tyrion something of a tumbler. I think that this ends up coming up a little bit in the later books.
That's right. It does. Yeah.
But what ends up happening, well, Martin gets criticized because of exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
Because of these types that certain little people are cast into. Mm-hmm. And so it could be that Martin is playing into those types. And it seems a little absurd. Like, he jumps off the ledge and rolls himself into a tight ball and is able to parkour himself onto the ground in a somewhat graceful way. And elsewhere in the book, he talks about how his spine hurts him and his legs are cramping him. It's almost like his body has betrayed him in a few ways. Mm-hmm. But in this one moment, he's almost a superhero or something.
Yeah, yeah, that's very interesting. It does come in very early in the book. Mm-hmm. And I could see why some readers would find that troubling. And yeah, it absolutely is playing with this ableist trope,
right,
that is been horribly misused. I guess it worked for me. Again, I'm kind of going back and forth between the books and the TV show. And yeah, are we doing spoilers, or are we assuming that people have read the books?
Yes, spoilers abound.
Because of course, later on, Tyrion is going to strangle his mistress.
That's right.
You know, who's obviously much bigger than he is. But he's able to overpower her and strangle her. So he is very strong.
He's strong, and he's in a few battles, too. In some ways, he is an able-bodied person.
Right.
And my sense is that, look, Martin's world is not an enlightened world in many ways.
No, that's for sure.
And and the few people that are sort of on the border of modern enlightenment are certainly not going to be enlightened enough for our standards. And on top of that, if you want to take it to a more metacritical level, even if Martin is a very progressive man, he's a progressive man writing in the early 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I do have some sympathy for people that try, even if they don't live up to everyone's standards, at least they're trying.
Yeah.
There is that aspect of it.
Yes, I agree. I agree. I think there is that aspect to it. And of course, that's always an issue when you're writing fiction, is you want to do justice to all of your characters. You're aware, of course, of the world you're living in, mm-hmm, and its injustices and the ways in which privilege or lack of privilege affect your standpoint. But in the end, you have to tell the story.
That's so right. And if I can just flatter you a little bit, you do a lot in your novels with the theme of gender, specifically very progressive notions of gender, and in a world that where it complicates everything, right?
Yeah. Well, and thank you. I appreciate that.
And I think you do it extremely well. And yet, I think we all have to be aware that in 50 years, people are going to read these stories with much different eyes.
Absolutely.
And find chinks in our armor that we had no idea were even there, even though we were really trying hard.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a great point, Anthony. And I guess to put another kind of little spin on this, I mentioned my best friend from graduate school when we were talking earlier.
Yeah.
My best friend from graduate school is a director, an actor, and he's really aware of who gets parts, who gets on stage, who gets in front of the movie camera or the television camera. And arguably, something important that Martin has done is started to create a wedge where little people become our actors, our heroes, and have major, major roles, mm-hmm, in a TV series. And again, Peter Dinklage is an important pioneer,
yes,
in saying, just this, you know, I'm a little person, but I'm handsome, I'm sexy, I'm a hero, I'm a fighter, as you pointed out, mm-hmm, I'm brilliant, and that's a big step forward in representation and, of course, in work for folks who want to do performance.
And so even though Martin couldn't foresee the way that disability studies have progressed, he certainly did open the door ever so slightly, you know. Let's not give him too much credit.
Right,
but he does
right.
deserve some credit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think absolutely, and an open door is an open door. So I think that's worth pointing out. Anyway, he is just such a fabulous character in the books, and the books really give us so much more character complexity than the TV series can, just because of how the mediums work. And he emerges as such a complex person who's, back to your point earlier in this podcast about jokes, who really uses humor in this complex way, but it's also, as you pointed out, it's also such an expression of his own woundedness and his own sense of hurt and pain, and that he manages to be so funny, so urbane, and so vulnerable kind of all at the same time mm-hmm. is, I think, a real testament to Martin's wonderful writing.
Do you think that, let me unravel a little theory that I have, and I'll ask you how it strikes you.
Love a theory.
Okay, so I think that Martin likes to put a new twist on old stories.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about him putting a new twist on War of the Roses. But if you think about, like, werewolf stories that begin to emerge in the medieval period.
Actually, yes.
We go all the way back to Greek stories, too. But if you think about werewolves, you could say that these Stark kids end up playing the part in some way. There's this line between wolf and human that is bridged. But not in a way that's typical. It's not like the moon comes up and, you know, people Hulk out or anything like that. But there is sort of a werewolf thing happening, especially with John in this story.
That's very, very interesting. And gosh, I think you're right. I was recently looking at a medieval, it's almost like a little novella, Bisclave. And it's about a gentleman, a knight, who becomes a werewolf.
Yes.
And he can't talk as a werewolf, but he retains all his courtly sentiments. And it's almost looking forward a little bit to the Beauty and the Beast original novel, which is French. And there is some of that feeling of Bisclave circulating in the direwolf Stark, you know, consortium of people.
Right. So that would be, it's not quite a fantasy creature. It's more of a, I don't know. I associate werewolves with horror.
Yes.
But one thing that is a fantasy, someone who would be very well known in the fantasy genre would be dwarves. And I wonder if Martin he's almost saying, okay, well, this story has to have some dwarves. But I wonder if what it would be like to really be a dwarf in a world like this.
Yeah.
It probably wouldn't have anything to do with mining, you know?
Right.
It probably would have to have more to do with being in a world that views Richard III as someone who's hated by the gods. Right. So I think that Martin does these. I think he grabs like ideas like tree spirits, ideas like werewolves, ideas like dwarves that really would fit well in a fantasy narrative.
Yeah.
But he's going to cast them in a new light for us.
I think that's a great point. And Anthony, as you were talking, I thought immediately, interestingly, not a Snow White, which was your first reference. And I thought about that second. But the first thing I'm thinking about the Grimm's fairy tales. And of course, the Grimm brothers are borrowing from all these medieval tropes also.
Right.
But I thought of Rumpelstiltskin. Rumpelstiltskin is bad.
Yes.
He's an evil dwarf and tricky and it's very, very clever. And it seems to me, now that you mention it, that Martin is playing with that trope also.
Yeah.
Because Tyrion is very clever and is able to manipulate people, but he's a good person. He's manipulating them for good, but he's absolutely borrowing from these old stories about dwarves and what they and you know, well, wait a minute, who are they? You know, what's it really like to be one? I think right. He's absolutely asking that question.
Are these people that liminal care, like they're magic, but they're other, right?
Yeah.
And they may just steal away your precious child in the night, you know?
Right.
It's
right.
This is a very, it's a very unenlightened way to right. view these characters. But I think what Martin's doing is he's saying, what would it really be like for a dwarf in this world?
Yeah. And the fact that they show up in so many tales, I think this is just a great point, suggests that, well, yeah, there were little people were in this world and they get sort of fetishized in mm-hmm. this odd way, as stories often are used to make, you know, they make sense of the world in some way.
I'm just going to read this section. So John is first noticing Jamie, and then he compares Jamie with Tyrion.
Yeah, yeah.
John found it hard to look away from him. This is what a king should look like, he thought to himself as the man passed. Then he saw the other one, waddling along, half hidden by his brother's side. Tyrion Lannister, the youngest of Lord Tywin's brood, and by far the ugliest. All the gods had given to Cersei and Jaime, they denied Tyrion. He was a dwarf, half his brother's height, struggling to keep a pace on stunted legs. His head was too large for his body, with a brute's squashed-in face beneath a swollen shelf of a brow. One green eye and one black eye peered out from under the lank fall hair, so blonde it seemed white. John watched him with fascination.
Yeah, what a description.
Clearly, John is forming opinions about, I mean, John has notions about what a noble and an ignoble man ought to look like, mm-hmm. right? Jaime Lannister looks every bit a king.
Right.
And Tyrion is just didn't strike the genetic lottery.
Right, right. Yeah, he's really described in this yes. very grotesque way.
And I remembering vividly this line from when they learn that Bran is alive, but paralyzed. Jaime says something along the lines of, "Oh, give me death. I'd rather
right.
have it. I wouldn't right. want to live as a grotesque."
Right.
And Tyrion right. says something along the lines of, "Well, speaking for the grotesques."
Yes, yes, I remember.
I would much prefer life because life brings with it so much possibility.
Right, right. right. And how dare you? How dare you decide, you know?
But how dare you ingest, right? He knows.
Yes.
I mean, his sword is sharp when it comes to humor. And he can do it in such a way that both he can defend himself, but he can also endear himself to people who would otherwise think ill of him.
Right. Yes, he's a really charming and fascinating character and commanding mm-hmm. in a certain way. And I think that becomes so clear at the end of the chapter where Tyrion says, "Never forget what you are.
Yes.
For surely the world will not make it your strength." And then he has that great line, "All dwarfs are bastards in their father's eyes."
Yeah.
And then he saunters off. That's such a great verb. So the language is changed because John is, of course, seeing him differently.
Mm-hmm.
So the verbs change. He saunters off, and then there's this great moment when he opened the door, the light from within threw his shadow clear across the yard. And for just a moment, Tyrion Lannister stood tall as a king.
Yes.
And I'm hearing a little tiny bit of Shakespeare, again, King Lear,
uh-huh.
every inch a king.
That's right. That's right. I love that because we just heard that Jaime looks every bit a king, right?
Right, right. That's what made me think of it. Yeah.
And I wonder if Martin is actually using a shadow to foreshadow.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering too.
Because there's a few moments where I think at one point Master Aemon says, "I see a giant come to us from, you know, to the end of the world."
Mm-hmm.
He's referring to Tyrion almost jokingly as a giant. But then there's also, there's this this Red Priest in a much later book,
Right.
Maybe in Dance, where the Red Priest, when he sees Tyrion, he doesn't see his exterior. He sees the giant he is.
Right. Well, the giant intellect, that's for sure. He's the smartest person in the books.
Right. So I wonder if this is Martin foreshadowing with a shadow that Tyrion will at some point either rise in station or experience some sort of magical transformation that we didn't see in the show. I'm really curious about the sort of Tyrion's outcome.
Yes, I'm curious about that too. And gosh, I'm hoping that it's more, that the endings are more interesting than the series. Just you know, to just quickly slip in my opinion there.
Well, we all have to register our vote every now.
Yes, we will. Although I think a lot of people have registered their votes, and they're with us. I think.
Yeah, that's right. Now I will say, Stephanie, there were really wonderful moments in that final season. I don't want to forget about those moments.
I don't either. Because
I think it's easy to focus on what we didn't
right, like, right? Right. Right. I agree with you. No, there were some wonderful moments. I agree.
So Tyrion, in so many rooms that he goes into, and mostly because he chooses to go in brothels and whatnot, Tyrion is the most wealthy, the most powerful person in the room.
Yeah.
And in those rooms, he's a lord.
Right.
And yet whenever he goes home to his family, he really is a second-class citizen. And I think that you could say the same thing of Jon Snow in a way.
Absolutely. Well, what I was thinking about while you were talking is, of course, we were talking about Jon as the problem baby, the unwanted baby. Well, Tyrion is that in spades. Mm-hmm. He's the real problem baby because he killed Mom. And he's little. But he's
an embarrassment to his father, who wants the Lannister propaganda to be perfection, nothing less than perfection.
Yeah, he wants the myth intact, and Tyrion really messes that up. So from that point of view, Tyrion is kind of an extreme version of the problem that Jon poses to the family, because Jon is also an embarrassment.
Right, that's right.
And there's Ned Stark, who is so, you know, holier than thou, more virtuous than thou. And I think Robert makes some comments about that. And he had this, he had this lapse with this woman, apparently. Yeah. And it's a stain on his honor. It's a stain on the family. And it really is a problem, as you pointed out, with the relationship. Catelyn's like, I thought he loved me, but he had this relationship with this woman that was so important that he brought the kid back. So what is that? That weighs on her.
Yeah, this is not a culture of individualism. As much as some of our favorite characters are able to find an individual identity that is satisfying to us, the default of this culture is collectivism.
Indeed.
Which means that, ethically speaking, the right choice is to do what will bring honor to your own family.
Right, to your clan.
If you are in a position like Jon or Tyrion, you are almost never able to bring any honor because your very existence brings only shame.
Yeah, brings dishonor, but just the fact of you.
The fact that you exist.
Yeah. No wonder Jon so desperately wants to find a place to belong that he's willing to give up his life basically at the age of 14 to go be on the wall, because it's some place where he belongs, and he's so desperate for some kind of positive feedback from someone, and he gets it from Benjen.
Yes.
And so he's like, yep, I'm going. You know?
That is his only avenue for honor, right?
Yeah.
And it just so happens that Tyrion has a much different view, we find out eventually. Tyrion has a much different view of what the wall is.
Yes, yes. Although something that I just wanted to share as we come to the end of talking about this chapter is, I love Tyrion's capacity for awe. Yeah. He's such a curious person. And we get a sense of that already with wanting to interact with Ghost, who's terrifying.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, who's objectively terrifying. And if you're Tyrion, size would be totally terrifying. But he's really interested in him.
Yes, he is. And so much so that he, his tumbling frightens the wolf.
Right.
And of course, John is, you know, John's trying to play up this is a really dangerous beast. And he knows that he's just a puppy at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
But Tyrion, he's not frightened. He knows what everyone knows, is that the way to someone's heart is through their most beloved pet, right?
Yes.
So you're right. He's absolutely curious. He's never seen a direwolf before. And so he wants the experience.
Yeah, and right? He's curious about the wall also. He wants to see it. It's one of the great wonders of the world.
Yeah.
And he is, as sophisticated as he is, he's continually willing to be surprised by things.
And he is.
To be in awe of them.
He is, and his, you know, his love of dragons is part of that. And I think he's a genuinely compassionate person, even though he puts on a good show. I think I don't think he would offer the advice he offers to John unless he actually cared about John's ultimate well-being.
I agree.
That makes him fundamentally different than someone like Jaime, who might give advice to different people at different times. But he's almost a nihilist. It's almost like it doesn't whether you take my advice or not, it really doesn't matter because you don't matter.
Yes.
And maybe I don't even matter, that sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah. There is a certain existentialist strain that runs through some of the characters in the book. I'm realizing as I think about it.
Yeah. And you could even say that Tyrion is he's a very Kierkegaardian character.
Yeah.
Because he's all about encounter.
Yeah. Right?
He's a very bright person, but he's tragic. You know, he battles with his own self. There are multiple sides to himself.
Yeah.
He's a doubter at times.
Yes, very much so, actually.
I never thought about that before, but there's a lot of Kierkegaard in
Yeah, in I just... You were the person who said, well, you know, we need to think about Martin as someone as kind of a hybrid writer. He's just working in a lot of different veins and a lot of different ideas. And something that I've been thinking about recently is there a sort of sense in some ways that existentialism and those modern philosophical trends are kind of walking around in places in these books? And I think they are.
I think they are too. And I think a great example of that would be that in the ancient world, you have atheists, but atheism means something else. Atheism means someone who is impious and will mock the gods and almost dare the gods to strike them down.
Yeah.
And then kind of live to tell about it. And so we call this person sort of against the gods, atheist. Mm-hmm. Modern atheism is more like, I don't believe in that superstitious nonsense. There are people that are like that in the ancient world, but that's not who the atheists are.
Yeah.
I do think that Tyrion is more of a sort of a modern, he's walking around with sort of a modern sensibility of atheism.
Yeah.
At times.
Yeah, I think so too.
Stephanie, I can't believe these conversations go by so quickly.
I agree. Such a fun time. Thank you so much.
I just for a veneer that we've kept the structure
must keep the structure
that I've designed here. I just want to mention a couple notable introductions in the chapter. Okay, so we hear of the Great Hall of Winterfell, Summer Wine, which I've learned from my friend Jana Matthews is a kenning. Two words put together like that. So Summer Wine. So Rickon is called the baby previously, but now he's called 3 years old. Tyrion squashed in face. We meet the word cur, which is an unwanted dog. We hear about Targaryen lore. All right. So we hear about the boy king Daeron. And I wonder if the HBO prequels will have any focus on this boy king.
Yeah, maybe. I just want to come back to our chapter, which has just been such a delight to reread. And as a fiction writer, I always value writers who can teach me something. And this chapter is such a brilliant example of how to use a point of view character to introduce other characters, yes, because that's what chapter 5 is doing. We're meeting Jon Snow and Tyrion, of course, and they're terribly important, but we're also getting snapshots,
yeah,
of every single one of the Lannisters in this very efficient, completely memorable way. We're, yes, like, okay, Cersei, green eyes, bad guy. Okay, here's Myrcella. Doesn't really know what she's doing. Tommen, kind of a non-player. Here's Sansa. Sansa likes the crown prince. Ooh, she likes him. And she's very beautiful. But take a look at Joffrey. Yeah. Joffrey's bad. Joffrey's pouting, and he's a bad guy. And so we get these wonderful kind of shorthand descriptions of these characters who were terrifically important, but Martin enables us to remember them. We have a, yes, kind of a shorthand. We're like, oh yeah, Joffrey the pouty kid, who's, Cersei the green eyes doesn't look at anybody, yeah, and so on. I just think it's great. It's just great writing.
It's almost like there's a certain alchemy involved in that. It takes a certain kind of element to reveal the characteristics of another element.
Yeah.
So you, in order to really showcase Tyrion well, you almost need a character like Jon, who may be a younger version of Tyrion.
Yes.
In order to really set up Tyrion for the kinds of lines that he needs to, right, deliver in order, right, to reveal who he is.
Yeah, Jon is almost the straight man. I mean, to think about this is almost a little bit of a comedy team, yeah, act in that last scene. And so you need the straight man. You need the callow youth.
You know, another coupling that I really like that has that is Arya and the Hound.
Yes.
And in many cases, Arya is playing the straight man. She's very serious about,
yeah,
her list and what she needs to accomplish and who should live or who should die. And, yeah, it just sets up the Hound perfectly for these wonderful lines, right?
Yeah, they are a fascinating pair. My, yeah, goodness.
Well, you know what? I like this pairing.
Me too.
I would love to have you on whenever you're willing. I'd love to talk to you about this particular topic, and I always learn so much.
I feel exactly the same way, Anthony. I loved learning about the phenotypes from the ancient world, which I actually did not know about. So that was awesome. And I loved your point about eyes as the theme of the chapter. That was great.
All right. Stephanie, thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you, Anthony.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends, and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now, Steve and I actually talk about an episode for a full 10 minutes. Steve, you just watched The Wolf and the Lion.
That's right.
Episode 5. What'd you think?
This one I dug. There was lots of swords, a lot of swordplay.
This episode had a lot of action.
It did. It had quite a bit of action.
And it was almost
more,
like...
A little bit more breastfeeding than I probably would have enjoyed. Well,
I was reading the wiki before we got on here, and it turns out that it is a prosthetic breast.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a prosthetic boy.
Right. It is
an animatronic boy.
It is Pinocchio. It's one of those grim tales of Pinocchio that we don't tell in the Disney version.
Sure, yeah. I want to be a real boy. Well, there's a price to pay, my son. Just a lot. I mean,
it's interesting to me, coming from a very pro-breastfeeding family. You have someone who's impaled in this episode.
Right.
You have a horse beheaded and several deaths by cutting with large instruments.
Yeah.
But the most memorable thing about this episode is the almost grotesque display of breastfeeding.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not helping the movement. It's not helping the free the nipple movement at all.
No, it really, I don't see it as a positive development.
No, not when you have what could be a 24-year-old. Mm-hmm.
Well, in the books, that character, Robert, is supposed to be around 6 years old, but the actor who plays Robert is actually 37.
Well, he has to be, right, legally, to do that scene.
Legally speaking.
That scene, not to get you in trouble. The guy's got to be pushing 40.
Right. So Tyrion goes east with Catelyn Stark, and they meet up with her sister, who's
touched. She's a little touched.
He's a little touched. Yeah, that's right. Lysa, the young fellow Robert.
Mm-hmm.
When he's done
thirsty boy. Yeah, little thirsty boy.
When he's done breastfeeding, he wants to make the little man fly. Meanwhile, Ned has found himself in something of a predicament. What is your impression of Ned Stark at this point?
That's a really good question, because I think the trope that may be the easiest to latch onto is that he's noble, right? And that, like, he's noble in a sea of treacherous backstabbers. I don't know that that's as simple as that. I think there's some sense of Ned having being more of a better moral compass than the rest of the characters.
Yeah, Varys says at one point, I think that there are very few honorable men in King's Landing, and I've been watching you, and I think you're one of them, right?
Yeah.
And I think Varys is probably right on that point. I think Ned is an honorable man or a noble man. The question is he too noble for his own good?
In that regard, I would say that he might be too principled for his own good. I feel like he strikes me as a very... Even though it may go against what the king desires, which is kind of like the gig, right? I mean, at least that's the way that the small council appears to be set up, is you give in to the whims of the king. But I think that he sees himself in this role as like, you didn't ask me to be your right hand to be one of these guys. And so I think he may have a tendency to err on the side of what he considers either the voice of reason, or maybe it's also to be just the counter opinion. And in his mind, you didn't bring me in here to be a lackey. You could have got somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever tried to catch a cat?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, how'd you do? Did you catch the cat?
No, you have to, you don't catch a cat by chasing a cat. You catch a cat by waiting for the cat, luring the cat.
Hmm.
You have to convince the cat that what you have, it wants.
So in the process of catching a cat, you're much more like Varys or Littlefinger. You create a trap for the cat.
Yeah, I would say that, yes.
You don't take the Stark approach.
Uh-uh, I don't think so. I haven't found that to be effective, but I don't have a lot of really great lateral movement.
Is that so? I didn't know that about you.
straight on, great. But cats zig, and I'm not a great zagger.
You know, that's something that many people don't know about rhinos.
Is that right?
Yeah, if a rhinoceros, I was told this by a native Zimbabwean, but if a rhino is charging at you, so let's say you're at 6 o'clock and the rhino's at 12 o'clock, mm-hmm. you want to run like at to like 1:30.
Oh, okay.
Because he can't turn. He will not be able to turn, which was one of the chief problems that I had with Black Panther, because those rhinos, they were doing like pinpoint turns in Wakanda.
Gotcha.
Other than that, it was quite a, it was almost a documentary.
So do you think, I mean, again, do you think, you may already know, the Lannister-Stark tete-a-tete at the end there, where Jaime Lannister, a guard, just basically comes over the top rope with a folding chair on Ned.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Was that a pre-discussed maybe on behalf of Jaime Lannister? Like, hey, man, if it looks like things are going south, I need one of you guys to give him the old.
I don't think so. In fact, I was wondering about that myself, because I think, knowing what I know of Jaime's character, he considers himself the best swordsman in the realm. And
clearly the best child pusher.
He's the best child pusher for sure. It's on the battlefield that he feels like he's the cleanest and the most virtuous. I don't think he would pay someone to go for Ned's calf or whatever. So I was wondering about that. And he ends up punching the guy afterwards.
Yeah. But I mean, that could have, you know, again, that could be for show.
But I thought it's a very strange that the guardsman did that. And I thought, I wonder if the queen, looking out for her brother, paid one of the guardsmen, hey, if it ever looks like it's going to go south, I'll give you a couple gold dragons, and you clip that guy from behind like Karate gotcha. Kid.
Yeah.
I don't know that actually is the case. It just seemed like an odd, it was, the timing was odd. The guy just stepped in and
yeah,
got him in the back. So the disagreement between Robert and Ned, this has kind of been building for a while. In fact, if you go back to the King's Road, Robert mentioned this girl across the sea, and he was thinking about killing her way back then.
Right.
But to me, it seems a little contradictory. On the one hand, Robert really wants a war. It's like he doesn't fare well in peace, and it's been too long since they've actually been on the battlefield, and he wants to be a warrior again.
He wants the joust.
He wants the joust. Yeah, he wants that sense of his youth again. And yet, he also wants to kill Daenerys.
Right.
Which would almost ensure that the Dothraki don't come across the sea. And so he wouldn't get his war in that case. This is all very strange to me. I don't understand the conflicting motivations here.
Well, I think that's important to look at that pre-joust conversation with Ned and Robert, right? I mean the whole thing. I mean, his guts hanging out. He's ribbing and torturing the young boy. Kind of an abuse of power. And then the fact that he wants to do this jousting thing, it speaks to the boredom. And Ned is, you know, telling him, hey, you know, you can go out there if you want, but you're going to win. You're going to win because you're the king. No one's going to challenge you. No one's actually going to challenge, right? So that, I mean, that sets up, that's sort of a foreshadowing for Ned, basically. Like, in that moment, Ned is challenging him, right? Ned is telling him, don't do this because it's not going to prove what you think it's going to prove. And essentially, he does the same thing with the orders to kill Daenerys. So it's the same thing. He's basically saying, look, and then what do they do? I mean, even his council is like, they basically refuse to even try to knock him off his horse. I think he's conflicted in the sense that he's like, yeah, he wants to get on the horse, but he also kind of wants someone to talk him out of it.
Hmm. If you could choose any character in this show, Steve, any character, and you had to have their hair, and you had to wear their hair for a year, like that character wears their hair, which character would it be?
Which character's hair would I wear for a year? Wow, that is not a question I thought I would. I mean, I could start going through who I would not. It would not be Joffrey. That's...
I was going to say, why not Joffrey? He's got a beautiful head of hair.
You're so much more pro-Joffrey than I'll ever be. Joffrey, you know, like, you know how when you get your iPhone and then it can do all these things, it can pinch your face, it can make your face look all big. He's the pinch face filter.
Look, he has a pinch face, but I'm not holding that against him. He can't help it. He is a product of incest.
Well, yeah. So, so you're going to grade him on a curve?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm going to do.
Fine. As far as incest faces go, not so bad.
All right, so you're not going to choose Joffrey's
I'm going to choose haircut. Joffrey. I'm not usually a fan of the long hair.
So you're not going to go with Ned?
I'm going to go with Ned. I mean, I am a fan of those sideburns.
Yeah, Sir Roderick's
sideburns. But again, I just feel like I got to learn to braid. It's a whole thing. You know, I could probably...
You know, Renly, the guy who's getting his chest shaved?
Yeah, yeah.
That's not so bad.
That's not a terrible look. I could do the Renly. I could probably pull off the Littlefinger.
Well, and he's a little salt and pepper too. That would actually, you'd look strange with a platinum wig.
Yeah.
But the salt and pepper wouldn't be so bad.
I think that would be, because see, as a guy who's been blonde or bald, I think I would really like to have a year looking like a medieval Mr. Fantastic.
Mm. Well, okay. That answers all my questions. And now here's a brief excerpt of my interview with David Peterson. David is probably best known for having invented Dothraki and High Valyrian. He's also done work for the MCU and a lot of other films and television shows. Most recently, he's been working on the upcoming Dune film. Here is David Peterson. David, I have asked this of various guests. Sometimes it makes it in the pod and sometimes it doesn't, but I've never asked this of a linguist.
Okay.
All right. I'm really curious to hear what you say about this. David Peterson, what is your relationship to your own voice?
I definitely hear it in my own head all the time. And I have to tell you, it's been changing recently. So I've always loved the sound of my own voice. I always talk to myself. I've done... Like I grew up just also doing voices, just imitating voices, doing things like that. That's what I grew up doing as a young child and have done for many, many years. It has disturbed me in recent years as I've felt the quality of my voice change. And especially how I hear it in my head. Occasionally, my own voice to me sounds like, what's his face? I can't even remember this guy. The dude with the curly red hair. He's been in Big Hero 6. He's been in...
I know who you're talking about. T.J. Miller.
T.J. Miller. There it is. Yes. It's made me very uncomfortable that hearing my own voice has reminded me of his voice in recent years. And that's a new thing. It's changed. Not all the time. Not all the time. But especially if I get a little tired or something. Or if I've eaten. And so that disturbs me because it sounds like something specific, something that I don't want to sound like, and it doesn't sound like me. That's an interesting question and one I usually don't get to reflect on. Right now, I should say, right now, I do feel very much like myself. And so I like that.
Do you feel like your love of imitation of different language or, I don't know, different voices when you were a kid... Mm-hmm. prepared you early on for your interest in linguistic studies?
Yeah, I think it did. I didn't think about it very much, in the early days of creating languages or anything like that. But yeah, I think it probably did quite a bit. And I think that it really helped me when it came to, getting the jobs that I do, because of course I record all of the lines that I translate.
Hmm.
And it helps. Basically, you have to kind of act the line because you're trying your very best to pronounce it exactly the way you think it ought to be pronounced. But so,
and a lot of times I'm imagining the actors are mimicking you.
Pretty much almost 100%. Yeah. They're just listening to exactly the way I do it and they're repeating it. Which means that if there are errors that creep in, they are my errors. So
you're like Cyrano de Bergerac analog to like Grey Worm and whatnot.
Well, not him specifically, I will tell you, because that dude is amazing. He is my number one favorite performer. of any show or movie I have ever worked on. He's so good. So good that he is head and shoulders better than me. And I can't say that about most of the actors I've worked with, in terms of like pronunciation, not, you know, acting that great.
The clearly underrated performance.
Yeah.
According to David Peterson. Okay. I wanted to ask you, I was looking at my Duolingo app today.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do the High Valyrian grammar for Duolingo, or was that someone else?
I did the whole thing and recorded every line. That's my voice.
That's your voice. I was just going to ask you, how do you feel about the guy who who recorded all those? But that you probably feel pretty good about him since it's you.
I feel great about him.
Oh, my goodness. I would imagine, I don't know if you can talk about this, but I would imagine that if I were a showrunner and I was going to be, you know, creating a spinoff from Game of Thrones and it was going to focus on the Targaryens, I might want someone who was an expert, maybe even someone who created the lion's share of the language to be on board with the project. Does that sound plausible?
I mean, it's definitely something I would want. And yeah, it's probably plausible. I mean, everybody has my contact info.
Okay.
But you know, it's always a question of if it's going to show up in the show or not. And, you know, you don't know.
You don't know. Yeah. You're going to have to wait and see on that one.
Mm-hmm.
One of my friends is Chase Stone. He does illustrations. He did a few illustrations for World of Ice and Fire.
Oh, cool.
And he did some dragon images. And he had one interaction with Martin, and the interaction was that he got just a single line of advice from Martin, and Martin said, "Dragons have claws, and they have fangs. They do not have spikes." And I want to know, do you have any such interactions with Martin?
I've had a number of interactions with him, a number that I really prize. I've actually got a whole series of emails between him, especially at the beginning when I was asking for his advice and for more specific information about Dothraki. And he has asked me for translations in the past. A couple of favorites. I asked him about the giants and their linguistic abilities at one point in time, because I was going to have to create a giant language, even though I didn't know it was for one line. Could have told me that. But and so I
wait.
I didn't know.
You're telling me you created the language for the giants and then they only used one word of the language in the show?
No, not one word, one line.
Oh,
the line only had ended up having three words, but
okay.
Yeah. One line. But I asked him, like, you know, I know that the giants speak the old tongue, but like, how fully developed is it? Is this something that's kind of more of a pigeon? Like, how does this work? And he responded, "The giants speak the old tongue after a fashion, but they are not altogether right." But I just couldn't believe that he used the expression "after a fashion" in an email to me.
Well, that's right. So, I mean, that's some really nice ass covering there. You have to admire that, because it allows him to say, yeah, it's in some way related.
It is accurate, though. Like, basically, they speak the old tongue as best they can, and right. It's not very well, because they're not very smart. So, like, yeah, I got it completely, and that was honestly all the direction I needed to be able to do what I had to do.
Oh, man, that's fantastic.
But in addition, I wanted to mention this. So George R. R. Martin has often commented that he doesn't, you know, have like a full Dothraki or High Valyrian language written up, that he just makes stuff up on the spot. But I was really impressed by the fact that everything created for Dothraki hung together so well. There were no inconsistencies, either at the grammatical level or the phonological level. And so then at one point, like he was asking me for translations for stuff for the map book. And so I sent him back some translations, and then, he said, "I also was thinking of doing, these," and he sent me some translations that he did on his own, using my reference materials, which he has.
Mm-hmm.
And I responded, I said, yes, that's exactly correct. I have to say, I'm kind of astounded because, I mean, these aren't forward-facing materials. They're materials for me, and they're written like a linguistic text. And I was like, I can't believe it. It's 100% correct. I'm really impressed that you got all that right. And he said to me, well, you sent me the grammar and dictionary for your language. So I reviewed the grammar rules and found the appropriate words and then put them in the correct order. It didn't seem that hard. And I was like, you'd be surprised.
You would be surprised, sir.
Yes, you'd be very surprised how hard that is for some people.
You know what? I love to know that about Martin, because I do think that sometimes when he gets compared to Tolkien, he gets kind of a bad rap that really he hasn't thought a whole lot of things through when he kind of is aiming as he shoots, like, you know, ready, fire, aim, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas Tolkien had it all worked out, you know, he had the foundation laid or whatever. But that story tells me that that he might write that way, but he takes seriously the ground that he's already laid. Like he's taking seriously the tracks behind him, and that's impressive.
Yeah, not only that, he has the, you know, the wherewithal to be able to do it very well. So, I mean, I was impressed.
Well, David, this has been super fun. I mean, I just love talking about this, and I've learned so much about you. And I hope the best. Are you working on any projects now that we should be excited about?
The movie I worked on that just came out was Christmas Chronicles 2, so that's on Netflix and featured a surprising amount of my language, especially compared to the first film. Pretty much done with season 2 of The Witcher. I think I probably just contributed my last bit last week. And so that should be in the can very soon. Season 1 of Shadow and Bone on Netflix, that should be coming out sometime. I think we're totally done filming that. I have no idea when it's coming out. There is another show I'm working on that I can't talk about.
All right.
So that's sometime in the future. And then there's another show that I'm working on that I can't talk about even further in the future. And then, of course, the Dune film, you know, in a very normal world, I would have been very excited to see that in 16 days. But, you know, the world being the way it is now, right. Dune has been pushed almost a full year to October 2021. They really want people to see it in theaters, evidently. And so they're like, they're really crossing their fingers and say, my God, by October of next year, please let us be normal again. You know, look forward to that, but not as soon as we all were hoping. And then aside from that, I do have a video game project that's going to come out sometime. And I'm very excited about that one. But like,
I don't know. Can you reveal the name of that, or does it have a name yet?
No, that one I can't. So trust me, if I can tell you stuff, I'll tell you stuff, but that one and the two shows, those are under wraps. And then I think I'm working on some other stuff, but I can't remember at this point.
Well, you've definitely taken advantage of 2020. You're probably busier than you've ever been.
It's well, not busier than I've ever been, but I've been very fortunate. Very fortunate this year to continue working on projects that I was already working on and to pick up some new projects because a lot of what was getting shut down was actual production, but the writing was still happening. And that's really the part where I'm involved.
Sure.
So
you mean they don't come to you? I always imagine that they came to you on the back end thinking like, okay, we're just going to put a blank here because, you know, they're going to put in gobbledygook and then we'll go get David and he'll fill in the blanks for us later.
Oh, they have. There have been productions that have tried that and which I just had to walk away from. Like the boys on Amazon, I couldn't believe that. They're like, we debut next month. I was like, are you kidding? You're premiering next month. And there was that one. And what was it? Star Trek Picard. That was another one. It just wasn't enough time.
Sure.
Yeah. So yeah, I had to pass on those.
Well, what a delight to talk with you about not just language building, world building. I mean, there's so much about the world building efforts of a fantasy narrative that really rely on the language construction. And and so it's really fun to get at it in that way.
It helps to set the scene. And so I appreciate it when authors put in the effort.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now for this week's Bird's Eye View. For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'd like to talk to you about werewolves. Because, of course, we know that John is going to, in some way, merge with a wolf. And we wouldn't necessarily think of that as following the rules of werewolves as we know them. Those rules being that there's a guy, and the full moon comes out and he wolfs out, and then when the moon goes behind the clouds, then he turns back into a human. No, this has not always been the standard rules for werewolves. Our thought on werewolves has evolved quite a bit. And this story from the Middle Ages is going to illustrate how our thinking has evolved. This story comes from medieval Ireland. It starts with a priest around a campfire. So this priest is traveling, and he's sitting by a campfire when a wolf approaches. And the wolf says, "Hey, don't be afraid, nothing to be afraid of. I'm actually a human who was turned into a wolf." The priest is a little skeptical, and the wolf's story is that he's got this curse on him. And this curse, unfortunately, turned him and his wife into wolves. And so the curse goes, they've got to stay wolves for 7 years, and then at the end of 7 years, someone else has to turn into a wolf, and they get to not be wolves anymore. But it always happens in twos. So he and his wife had been turned into wolves. But they're Catholic, and his wife is close to death. So they need a priest to administer last rites. Well, the priest, as you might imagine, is a little skeptical. So he quizzes the wolf on right Catholic doctrine. The wolf is able to answer every one of the priest's questions. He truly is a tried and true Catholic. So the priest goes with the wolf into the woods. And sure enough, they find his wife, a she-wolf, who is underneath a tree, in the hollow underneath a tree. And the wife is close to death, and so the priest administers last rites, And then the wolf asks for a second favor. This time he wants Holy Communion. Well, this is just too much for the priest. The priest is like, priests do not administer Holy Communion to wolves. Thank you very much. And he gets skeptical again. He's like, I don't know if you're really humans. And so the wolf thinks, well, what can I do to convince you that we're really human? And what he does is he takes his wolf claw and he rends his wife from chin to navel. And he opens up, folds back the wolf skin, and there underneath the wolf skin is the human form of an old woman who's close to death. Well, the priest is totally convinced, and so he offers the wolf and the she-wolf Holy Communion, and then the wolf replaces the skin of his wife and walks the priest back to the road. Nothing bad happens to the priest. In fact, the wolf gives him some really great advice. It gives him directions, and they have a conversation about occupied Ireland, and the wolf has some weird suggestions about how God ordained certain countries to be occupied and certain countries to rule. That's kind of weird. So everything goes fine for this guy. He leaves, and then eventually he gets into trouble with his synod because was it right to give a wolf communion? And Gerald of Wales, who is recounting this story, names himself as someone who was sought for advice on this particular matter. So he writes a letter to the synod. It's Gerald's opinion that lots of things transform from one thing to the next. And while the human form is the image of God, and therefore you only give Holy Communion to the human form, some exceptions can be made. For instance, we all know about witches who turn into rabbits. Everyone knows about that, right? So this is maybe not that different than the witches that turn into rabbits. We also know that there are these poor women that get turned into cattle at one point so the witches could, you know, make them do the work of the field. And then these women turn back from cows into women again. And then Gerald of Wales, being a good Catholic, says, and don't forget that the bread and the wine of communion transform into the body and blood of our Lord and Savior. So let's not be too quick to judge a human who's turned into a wolf. So Gerald of Wales agrees. What's the problem? Give Holy Communion to werewolves. And I agree with that too. If ever I met a werewolf, I've got no problem with werewolves being as Catholic, as much or as little as they'd like to be. That's religious freedom, folks. And that's all for this week.
Next time on Electric Boogaloo.
You are pregnant with a baby.
Right.
You have to eat an entire horse heart.
Right, yeah. I guess I didn't quite understand. Like, if she couldn't eat it, what happened?
I think she's going to throw up.
Yeah, but then what does that mean for the baby? Does that, like...
No one wants to throw up, dude.